All right. Hello and welcome to Great Things with Great Tech, Episode 6. My name is Anthony Spiteri, and this podcast is all about highlighting companies doing great things with great tech. In this episode, I'm lucky to be talking to you, Justin Giardina from iLand. Justin is Chief Technology Officer. Welcome, Justin.
Thanks for having me.
Awesome. It's great to have you. So just before we start, just a few announcements and before we get into it with Justin. So if you love great things with great tech and would like to feature on future episodes, you can click a link in the show notes or go to launch.gtwgt.com and register your interest. And just a reminder that all episodes of GTWGT are available on YouTube and all podcasting platforms like Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and everything. We're everywhere now. So with that out of the way, Justin, let's get rolling. So iLand, you know, when I started this whole podcast, I wanted iLand on almost from day zero. You and I go a fair way back, both obviously working in the hosting industry. iLand is one of these, I guess, I call them a super infrastructure as a service provider, right? A super cloud provider. Not quite at the level of the hyperscalers, but when you look at the step below, definitely you guys are top of your game. So before we dig into the history of iLand, I just wanted for you to give the listeners a bit of a background on yourself. I know you joined iLand kind of not at the start, and we'll get to that, but just for the listeners, how did you get started in the industry?
Sure. So, you know, luckily for me, I always say this, you know, I feel fortunate that a hobby or an interest that I had back even when I was 13 years old turned into a career.
Yeah.
So that's, I think, a key thing to think about, because that's what really keeps me interested, just the love for technology. When I was younger, I got into Unix systems very early. I actually got into, you know, just to say it out loud here, I guess, hacking at an early age.
Ooh,
with
some of my friends. Dangerous. Like 15, 15. Ethically hacking. Ethically
hacking. Back when the internet was a better time and place, I guess. Not so much today with criminal activity and stuff. But yeah. I got into computers at an early age. I started working. I'm actually from New Orleans, so I started working in the New Orleans area for a consulting company, doing a lot of web hosting, a lot of networking, Cisco reseller and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I worked in New Orleans for many, many years. And then when Hurricane Katrina came around in 2005, I actually moved with the company I was with out to Houston. And about a year or two later is when I found iLand, and I applied, and here I am today.
There you go. That's amazing. Yeah, it's funny how just, you know, situations in life bring you to the right spot, you know. And, you know, I think from you starting in 2008, which we'll get to later, you've, you know, best part of 12 years and, you know, running a very successful sort of tech platform. So iLand, like many companies, if we drop back into the 90s, lots of companies, and I'm finding this more and more as I do research with this show, is that any company that survived till today but was founded in the 90s all started the same way, effectively. And iLand's no different. Founded by Scott Spavero and Brian Usher in 1994, from memory. And effectively founded as a development / web hosting company. Is that pretty much how it started?
That's true. So back then, Scott was doing a lot of the sales, and Brian was doing the programming side.
Oh, so Brian was actually, Brian was developing.
He was. Basically back then, you know, this idea or concept of websites was a very foreign thing to the masses.
Yeah.
So Scott and Brian actually met each other in high school. And after high school, they both went off to college and got back together and started to form iLand in Houston.
Yeah.
So back then they were developing websites, you know, doing what was e-commerce back then. What that did was led them to multiple contracts. They started hosting people's websites on other infrastructures and other companies' infrastructures.
Mm-hmm.
Then from there, they started to say, hey, customers are wanting their own servers. So let's take a look at maybe hosting and managing customer servers for them.
Yeah.
That led into, hey, now that we have these servers, we actually need a real data center and data center space. And
so
for
back
the first
then, back then it was real servers, right? We're not talking virtual or anything. This is like the late 90s, dot com boom. We're talking maybe, I don't know, like gray or cream colored compacts or something. I mean, that was kind of the thing back then, right? So
I wish I was actually in the office and we weren't having to deal with so much remote, because we actually saved some of those servers. And you're exactly right. They were the cream color compact, and then also some very old cream colored super micros. So
wow, super micros back then. That's pretty impressive. So yeah, so Brian was the dev and Scott was like the sales. And I guess from there it kind of grew the company up until, you know, the 2000s. But what was the size of the company kind of around, you know, in the 2000 mark, just after the .com?
So very small. I mean, as you mentioned, I joined the company in March of 2008. And when I joined, we only had about 10 to 12 people.
Okay.
So I would imagine that it was just as small before then. I'd have to ask Scott and Brian.
Yeah.
But again, you know, with the website hosting, email hosting, a lot of the .com level services was the main function of the company. And then, like, as I mentioned too, as we get into the early 2000s, we started doing a lot of co-location. That led us to be in about 50 data center presence partnered with Level 3 globally.
Okay. Yep.
And the bread and butter of the business for that first 12 or 13 or so years was exactly those services.
So already back then, you're already basically going out to other data center locations and basically co-locating equipment globally at that point.
Yeah, so it could be, you know, sometimes customers just needed a couple of use of rack space. Sometimes a customer needed cabinets, and sometimes a customer would need a suite. But if you actually look at our story or some of the, you know, videos we had back in the, as Brian likes to call it, the .bomb era, there was a lot of data center space that was open. So what Scott and Brian did was we were able to actually partner with Level 3 and get that data center space for pennies on the dollar. And that's what allowed us to expand in this global market. And then to your point before, that could, some of the cabinets held Island's internal infrastructure. Some of that was customer internal infrastructure. But as I said, that was the main focus of the company up until about 2008.
So when you say Level 3, just explain that for the guys out there that don't know what a Level 3, I guess, data center is at that point.
Yeah, so Level 3 had obviously a global presence. They still do. Level 3 was acquired, actually, but back in the late 90s, 2000 timeframe, Level 3 had data center presences everywhere.
Yeah.
Some data centers I can say were nicer than others.
Yeah.
But basically they had huge floor spaces in multiple markets. And we strategically chose those based on customer demand or based on where we thought there would be a demand for co-location and services in those data centers.
Yeah.
And that's what I mentioned, that we had presence in about 50 Level 3 sites globally.
Nice. Okay. Excellent. And, you know, so that's kind of in the 2000s. I guess from that period of time, everything was just cruising with regards to web hosting. There was a transition though, you know, it would have been about 2005, six, like most hosting companies that were doing that, to look at virtualization and to see where that would take them. And I'm guessing Island was no different. So from your experience, I mean, obviously this was maybe just before you joined, but was Island getting into the virtualization infrastructure as a service hosting even back at, in sort of that mid 2005 timeframe?
No, not yet. I mean, when I joined, we were still a very physical company, as I mentioned, whether it be Supermicro or Dell or Compaq, whatever the vendor was, most services were physical.
Yep.
And we also were doing a lot of like network management, or Island was doing a lot of network management at the time, like managed firewalls, switches, routers, things like that.
Yeah.
And for me, before I joined Island, when I was working in Houston and later on in my career in New Orleans, I worked in the petrochemical industry. So it was oil and gas somewhat, but more of packaging and processing petrochemicals. And we actually were embarking on this, you know, back then, that's when SAN storage was out. Obviously, it was pretty much fiber channel back then.
Yeah.
But you had things like VMware. You had things like GSX, you know, ESX was coming out. There was no ESXi. This is back in the vSphere 3 and 3.5 days.
Yeah.
And when I joined Island, that's when I took that knowledge that I had from the petrochemical industry. And we started talking about, hey, well, we have all these physical footprints. Let's talk about what we can do with this new thing called virtualization, right?
Yeah, awesome. So 2008 is round about when you joined, but it was also, you know, pretty hectic. You know, obviously at the moment we're in some pretty hectic times with regards to pandemics and, you know, financial crises that have been triggered by that. But 2008 was obviously the last big GFC. And I kind of remember that time as being when I was working for a smaller hosting company at the time. We were doing all sorts of hosted Microsoft products and, you know, IIS web hosting, PHP web hosting, that sort of thing. But we boomed during the GFC. I remember hosted Exchange went through the roof. I mean, there's a lot of hosted services. Is that what you experienced when you first started at Ireland as well, that there was just this boom because of the GFC, as ironic as that is?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's funny you mentioned that. You know, prior to 2008, we had a big jump as a company with hosting Frontpage, actually.
Oh, Frontpage, really? Wow.
Yeah, late 90s.
I never got into that. I never did that. I kind of stayed away from that.
Yeah, I mean, that was before my time as well, but it was one of those things where we offered a service, and back then you had something called like Frontpage server extensions.
I remember, yeah, it was nasty. Always used to break down.
yeah, it is what it is, right? But what had happened was we actually supported those services, got vetted by Microsoft, and Microsoft put Ireland on Microsoft.com as a Frontpage hosting provider, as one of the only ones.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Your point about taking off with services, that really took off for us back then. But to get back to the point about the 2008 timeframe, you know, we really never got into hosted Exchange. And other than the Frontpage, we really didn't do too much from an application hosting perspective.
Yeah.
We were mainly just on the infrastructure side. But we did see, you know, the dawn of what we're calling the cloud today. And back in the 2008 timeframe, if you think about the landscape, you had big players out there like Rackspace at the time. You started to see Amazon start popping up. But really in 2008, it was very focused on Linux, and it was very focused on public machines. So for instance, you could spin up a Linux server in 2 minutes, but you had a public IP address, and that was really it. A lot of Ireland's customers were enterprises, and that may have been good for maybe a web presence, but it really didn't help them on moving to the quote unquote cloud or to a hosting provider, because they had multiple things like physical gear or multiple VLANs, or just, I don't want to use the word complex, but more advanced networking than just a public IP address.
Yeah, more bespoke, case by case sort of situations. Everything was different per customer, pretty much, with their own little needs and requirements. That's, you know, that adds complexity to setups and, you know, the way that you would approach that. Yeah, that's interesting. Okay, so you guys didn't dive into the hosting as such. You guys kind of kept to your game, which was, you know, networking, I guess, servers and infrastructure at that point. So you never really did that application or SaaS-based hosting, which is interesting. And I guess even today, you guys really don't do any of that. But you do a little bit of the disaster recovery. Well, actually, not a little bit. You guys kind of became synonymous with DR, really, and backups as a service. But I guess we'll get to that, because that's what I really want to hone on, you know, later on in the actual episode. But just moving forward, so what's really funny is in 2010, Ireland was named as VMware's Service Provider of the Year. And you guys are kind of, again, serial sort of award winners for this sort of stuff right across a whole heap of vendors, right? You guys are great at getting this. And that's obviously a feather in your cap. And, you know, you don't just get those awards for the hell of it, right? So you guys obviously have done some things right there. But was that the first of those awards that you guys got in 2010? And I'm guessing that was on the cusp of when now, did you guys use or not use vCloud Director at the time?
Yeah, so to answer your question about 2010, you know, I mentioned I started in 2008. What we started to do was take a look at how we could build a complex virtualization infrastructure for our customers that were getting off the physical world, but have enterprise-grade functionality, right? So like I mentioned, things like VLANs and VPNs and just what an actual enterprise would need to use. And it probably took us about a year or so to get our stride, you know, basically starting from nothing. We were fortunate enough, or I was actually fortunate enough, to put the first couple servers in Houston in 2009 to watch this grow.
Yeah.
So we really didn't really hit our stride and figure everything out until later 2009 and 2010. But when we started, we were just a traditional vSphere stack. vCloud Director wasn't in the picture.
Yep.
But as soon as vCloud Director came out, one of the biggest things back then was, how do you give customer multi-tenant access to vCenter without doing this VPN and all these crazy things that you would have to do to give the customer control of their environment? And that's when vCloud Director came in. So to answer your question, I think it was us and maybe like four other providers at the time. I know BlueLock was in there. Right. So BlueLock is, some of those guys are still around. They got purchased, but guys like Ben from BlueLock, you know, he's still around and stuff. But to answer your question, the We did bite off on vCloud Director 1.0. We drank the Kool-Aid with, I think you did as well. And we also, you know, faced those challenges early on. But once we got that, it was very good for us because that's when we could start doing more things from a programmatic perspective with the vCloud API.
Yeah, the API.
And as you know, vCloud Director started progressing to where it is now, you know, in
version 10. I think, you know, it exemplifies the fact that, you know, the interface, an interface can be problematic and maybe cumbersome, but if the API is in place, then you can do a lot with it, right? So at that point in 2010, did you guys already have a console or a front end, or?
We did not. So I guess if you think about the VMware timeline, we started with a vSphere type of multi-tenant access approach. We migrated over to vCloud Director. And while that was a great step, if you remember, or even today, there's a lot of limitations with vCloud Director. Sure, you can power on VMs, open consoles. And as I mentioned too, you know, there's a lot more functionality in version 10 than there was in version 1, but you were still limited to things like billing, performance metrics, and a lot of the feedback we got early on was, hey, this vCloud Director interface is okay, but you know, if we're coming from a vCenter environment or a vSphere environment and you want us to move all our workloads to your cloud, we can't operate like this as like a sysadmin, right?
Yeah.
So that's when a couple years later, we were like, okay, I think it's time to build our own interface that we can start managing these types of things programmatically and showing the customer what they need.
Yeah. And you make a really good point there, right? Because I think a lot of people that shifted their workloads at that time from on-premises to a cloud really weren't ready. And even today, to a certain extent, they're not ready to give up full access or full visibility and full administrative feel of their servers or their workloads. So to the fact that you didn't have a workable sort of way to look at metrics to see what your machine was doing, even the console at times was a bit flaky, like that just makes people not really want to jump all in with it. So the more that you can do to build around that, the more successful you're going to be. And I think you guys did that. When did you guys actually release that first console, just out of interest?
So I believe it would probably be like 2012. So
2012, okay. That's memory. Yeah. I'm trying to think back in my head because 2012 was when I think I first had a personal interaction with iLAN. And it was actually when I was working for a company called Anatel, and we were, again, a vSphere infrastructure service provider, much like what you guys were, very small, obviously. We actually hosted more websites than infrastructure, but we still did the infrastructure for people and clients around the country. But I had a customer that was doing business out of the UK, and they wanted to have some presence in the UK, like one web server or two. It was two web servers at the max. And I was like, how am I going to do this easily? And to my point before, I wanted some sort of access in to be able to do what I wanted to do with the servers, right? And lo and behold, who did I find but iLAN? And so I remember I emailed someone and then basically got the username and password and literally got into vCloud Director and set up two web servers, and I was consuming iLAN back in 2012 for a customer of ours. And then I was on selling it. I was thinking I was double billing and on selling it to my customer at the time. But I just remember that it was just so easy to get on, and it was just, the experience was great end to end, right? So I think that was a really good feather in the cap. So was London, now that we talk about a little bit of expansion, was London the first place that you guys expanded to and had a separate data center presence where you had services hosted out of?
So as I mentioned before, you know, when we had that global expansion, when we partnered with Level 3 early
Level 3,
on, we had a presence in London and Manchester and Amsterdam. But when you start thinking about our cloud rollout,
yes,
London was the first, at least in EMEA location. So we did deploy that relatively quickly.
Yeah,
we started in the States, went to London. And then as customer demand grew, and as I know we're going to get into the DRAS talk a little bit later, but as DRAS also started to take a hold and people started wanting like site-to-site replication and stuff, that's when we started expanding in the market. So for instance, if we were in London, obviously you don't want to replicate to somewhere else in London, you want to replicate into some other geographical areas. That's when things like Manchester came on and so forth.
So on the expansion, I'm always curious as to what is the go for an expansion. So when do you guys, obviously there's an element of business to it, there's an element of tech, But when do you guys get together and say, okay, now we need a point of presence, a cloud location in London? Or I remember when you guys went into Singapore, and then I remember when you guys went into Sydney. That was actually more recently, and obviously everywhere else you've gone to. But how do you make that decision to actually put something in there?
You know, it's a couple different things. It's customer growth and demand. You know, we work with a lot of multinational companies that maybe start off in our Dallas location or London location and need to expand for their data center presence.
Yeah.
Like I mentioned before, there's a lot to do with resiliency. So if we have a data center in London, people want to replicate out of London or back up out of London to somewhere else in the UK, like Manchester. Also, when things like Brexit came around, people were looking to leave UK and maybe migrate into something like Amsterdam.
Yeah.
And then there's also just like new markets, right? When you talk about Singapore, we did have some customers that drove that, building of that data center. But also it just opens up some new doors. So as you mentioned, yeah. We partner with a lot of vendors like Veeam and Zerto. We can also support some of those vendor footprints in these new locations as well.
Yeah, because I guess at some point, I mean, so what you're talking about effectively is you typically would have an anchor client that would take you to that particular location, and then the feasibility grows from there. But some of them as well are a little bit of leap of faith, like, you know, build it and they will come sort of situations as well. So it's obviously a fine balance. But in terms of your global rollouts, what have you got? Is it 11 DC or 10 DC locations now? What have you got at the moment?
Yeah, 10 locations. Yeah, so in some geographical locations, we have multiple what we call pods or, you know, stacks of footprints that we have. Like in Dallas, there's multiple. But yeah, that's right. On our locations section on island.com, you can see them. But we're pretty well distributed across the globe. And we have over 10 locations today.
Awesome. All right. So I guess, you know, let's move into the 2010s a little bit in terms of history and go into, I think, what really sets you guys apart now and where I think there was a pivot of sorts. 2011, 2013, you've mentioned it before, when you kind of said, okay, we've got to get into this DRaaS and backup as a service. Just explain to us, you know, what the drive was there and how Island has been able to effectively, because I think in 2014, Island was named as a leader in the Forrester Wave for DRaaS. And then you've also been, I think from 2016, in the Gartner Magic Quadrant for DRaaS providers. Like that's huge, right? So explain to us how it became that, because I think a lot of infrastructure providers that were doing just pure infrastructure VMs realized at a certain point that they had to change and pivot a little bit for the changing world and to sort of work against the flow of the public cloud providers, and DRaaS and BaaS, I think, was it. So just explain to us a little bit how that came about and how you guys have succeeded at that so well.
Sure. So I think what's equally important to mention is, you know, we did talk about our console coming to fruition early on, but really I think the main reason we can be so successful and get some of the accolades you mentioned was because of the platform we built. So, you know, we choose to use best of breed products. We choose best of breed products that can be programmatically dealt with via API or something like that.
Yeah.
And what we did early on was we built a data platform with an internal and an external API to control all this infrastructure.
Your own, right? So, this is your own.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is like the Island IP or the Island secret sauce, if you will.
Yeah.
And what we've done is we built a globally distributed data warehouse platform that is data is distributed and synchronized across all of our locations. And then we've also built different collectors and services that talk to all the various components of the things that run the cloud. So you have Veeam, you have Zerto, you have vCenter, NSX, everything that we use in our stack is programmatically accessed and could also be delivered to the customer via a public API. But you mentioned our console. Our console is just a client of our public API. So early on, what we wanted to do was really build a platform that said, okay, if we're using things like Veeam, if we're using things like vCenter, NSX, Trend Micro, all the different things, we want to deliver those as a service to the customer that they can programmatically access, but they can also access via our UI. So very early on, we decided to give, I hate to use the term single pane of glass, but we have that single pane
of glass. Oh, that old chestnut, eh? Yeah.
Right, into all of the various services that we offer, right, with complete billing and metrics and getting back to the story I mentioned before about vCenter admins wanting to see that level of detail. So we built that all in the platform. So when you start talking about how we succeeded in DRES and BAS, is that by virtue of us having this extensible platform, all these features around networking, DRES and BAS are a very easy thing to tack onto because that underlying platform is there to do that work, right?
So yes, get it.
Anybody nowadays can move data, right? You can get a very cheap way to move data, or you can a very elegant way to move data. But when you start talking about DRES, all the magic is in, or backup, if you will, all the magic is in what can you do with that data when you need to use it, right?
Yeah.
And that's where our platform really comes into play, where we can say, okay, hey, things like, you know, networking, or you don't need to change your IP addresses, or you need to pull in MPLS circuits or BGP, all those things are done by the platform and the customer has full control of that. So when you do use the data mover, whatever brand you choose, and you click failover or restore, all of the things to actually use that data, manage that data, be compliant are all built in the platform.
So how many of you, I've just remembered an interesting story about how we actually first started communicating and chatting all that time ago, but I'm intrigued by the whole API thing, right? And how you allow your customers to consume it via API via the console. So what percentage of your customers would actually consume your services via the API?
I would say in the beginning, it was very little. Nowadays, when you have people that are using our cloud with maybe other clouds or looking at things like Terraform, or maybe even people writing their own scripts with Python, or maybe using like SaltStack and Ansible, we're starting to see a lot more people use the API. Now, I won't say it's 100%, but it is a lot bigger. And another big, big use case that people are using the API for is consuming billing metrics into their accounting platforms.
Interesting.
And also for compliance and change control. So I know we don't have a lot of time to go into like every single feature of the platform, but we spent a lot of time on security and compliance. And for customers to be able to do things like consume messages or consume changes that either their admins or our admins make has been very complimentary, so that they can, you know, pull that from the API, store that in their change management database, and get better visibility into what's going on in the cloud and on.
Yeah. Well, what's really funny is, and that story that I was going to tell was that when I was at Zettagrid, obviously Zettagrid had a quite nice use front end as well, quite a good portal, which was getting kudos. But whenever I was working with the developers to try and make it better, there was only one person that I was actually looking at to try and copy, and that was Ireland at the time. you know what I mean? So I used you guys as that pinnacle as to what we wanted to get to. So it was funny because in the ANZ area, everyone was looking at Zettagrid, and then whereas I was always looking at Ireland and you guys, you know, because I saw what you guys were doing. I loved it. I remember asking you, I'm like, man, they must have like hundreds of programmers like working on this, doing their thing, right? So I remember I got on Twitter. I asked you on Twitter. I said, hey, man, how's it going? Love your work. Well, how many guys do you have running this thing? And I think you kind of came back and said you had like 3 devs. And I was like, what the hell? Like, that's crazy. You know, that something this good was done by so few. But yeah, that's just efficiency, right? But also, I think being just so maniacally focused on what you guys wanted to achieve, and also finding some great people as well. But I thought it was really, really great.
Yeah, I mean, that's a true testament to, you know, I wish I could sit here and take all the credit for everything, but that's a testament to the awesome people we have at Island. You know, I mean, working with and being amazed by what I see come out of the company on a daily basis is truly a pleasure. And back in the early day, you know, I was about to say this earlier, I have a friend of a friend who I met, you know, years ago. And when we were looking, I was like, hey, you know, does Julian maybe want to come work here maybe? And my friend was like, yeah, I think he's actually, you know, closing up one of his jobs that he's doing, and why don't you talk to him? So I wound up speaking with Julian, and, you know, back in the early days, it was really just Julian developing most of these things.
Wow,
and
yeah.
Then back in the time when you pinged me, we had a small team, like 3 or 4 people. Yeah. And that core team was the people that did the truly amazing thing of launching the first versions. Now, of course, we've grown since then.
Yeah.
But yeah, back in the day, it was a very small crew of just people working very hard.
Good stuff. So yeah, so now we come to today. You know, we guys are obviously still very successful, still winning those awards and still doing quite well. But I wanted to, and I guess you've kind of answered in a way, but now I just want to ask a few sort of pointed questions. So, you know, what are the core innovations and services that you are built on? So you've mentioned a few, but in terms of, you know, so you've mentioned VMware, Zerto, Veeam, Trend Micro and whatnot, but underpinning that, what else do you kind of build the ILAND stack on?
So as far as the IP, I mean, we're a huge open source user, and the back end of the back end systems, I mentioned the data warehouse we use is called Cassandra.
Cassandra.
We use a lot of you know, Golang, Python. I mean, we use the whole gamut of technologies, but our actual platform is built on open source. As far as the vendor system, you know, you mentioned VMware, Trend Micro, HITRUST, HPE, Nimble. We use a lot of the best of breed product sets, but as I mentioned, we not only will choose the best of breed, but one of the main things we always need to focus on is that we can programmatically access this vendor stuff, right? So nowadays, it's a lot easier to get an API-driven platform versus, you know, what we experienced 10 years ago.
Yeah.
So at least that part's a little bit easier. But a lot of what we do and the reason why we've been successful is because of the internal people at ILAND and the IP we've written. So sure, we do rely on that vendor ecosystem, but as I mentioned before, having that single pane of glass, like Outlook on how a customer consumes our services, we can bundle all of the backend functionality, visibility, and give that to the customer either programmatically or in the UI and, you know, provide an easier experience. We don't believe that, you know, hey, if you had 10 vendors that made up the security feature of our cloud, we want you to log into 10 vendor UIs to access that stuff.
Yeah.
Right? And that to me, that's just not great.
Yeah.
So we spend a lot of time on not doing that.
So I think you've answered the question about how did you disrupt the market. I think you disrupted it by thinking a little bit differently, I suppose. And that web console / API approach is the way that you've disrupted the market, I think. Is that a fair thing to say in terms of your key disruptive feature?
Yeah, I think so too. And if you think about it, you know, it's good to have the native administration tool set for the various ecosystem we use. Because remember too, behind the scenes, we have an operations team. We have people that need to come in and deal with ESXi patching and vCenter patching and vCenter maintenance, right? So all those things are there, but the end result to provide to the customer via a seamless, you know, a seamless mechanism is the key, in my opinion, to our success. Yeah. And it also gives sets us up to be a very modular company too, right? So like we're using Trend Micro today, we're using VMware today. Obviously those products evolve, maybe something else comes on the market, but being able to instantly say, okay, if something else comes, we can integrate it, but also give the customer the same user experience has been what's kept us alive all these years.
That's awesome. Just quickly, have you got a name for your API? Is it like some sort of fancy name or is it just like API?
API.islandcloud.com is where you can go look at the Swagger docs. You know, let me just say this. We do have fun code names for the releases. Yes.
Yeah. that's good. Yeah. I was just wondering really, like I'm just thinking about Silicon Valley and Son of Anton and Anton and they're just crazy names for those sorts of situations. So I thought maybe ILAND had some interesting one. So with that, so how will you continue to internally disrupt yourselves to continue to innovate? Cause that's a challenge, right? So internal disruption.
Yeah, so there's the public side, you know, there's versions of software, that's where the market is going. We start to think about people starting to use containers and what our roadmap looks like from a public perspective. We're all, or a consumer perspective, we're definitely tied into that. But what we've also been doing over the years and what's not necessarily publicly known is just like we have an API that's public and a console that's public for users, we also have streamlined our internal operations in the same way. So we have internal tooling that talks to all of our internal systems,
things like Salesforce
and our accounting system. And we can do things from a programmatic or business analytics perspective to drive things like automation and, you know, free test drives and stuff. We have spent a lot of time building that as well. So that's how, when you mentioned before, you know, we had a few people developing the console. Obviously, it's a lot more now, but that's how we can drive innovation both internally and externally.
Yeah.
And then, of course, as you mentioned, it's just staying alive with the market. You know, if you think back about what you mentioned about Scott and Brian starting the company in the 90s, you know, people don't use Front Page anymore. People don't use websites hosted on IIS anymore themselves, yeah. Right? So it's that constant staying in tune with the market, which has kept us alive. And that's like our bread and butter, right? We just need to stay on top of our game and be innovative. And I think we can keep moving along.
Yeah. And I think also you do some sort of quirky side things as well I think they're quirky from a company or maybe left of field, like that lab engine that you guys basically have. Just explain very quickly, because we're getting short on time, but just quickly explain lab engine, because I think that's pretty cool.
Sure. So like for many years, we've provided backend infrastructure for events. So like, you know, VMware before they had hands-on labs, VMon events, ZertoCon, there's a whole bunch of events that we backend. And basically what we saw was that there wasn't a really good platform for people to say, okay, I have this template. I want to maybe show off the new versions of Veeam V10. So what does that actually mean? You need V10, you need an ESXi server, you need vCenter, you need this stack of services. We really didn't find that there was a good way for people to say, okay, I want to build this in the cloud. I want to clone it a bunch of times and I want to have a scheduling system, you know, a kiosk-based system where you can allow people to access these environments. And although it seems a little quirky, it's been really popular for us for not only events like VMon. For instance, we've done the VMon hands-on labs with that infrastructure for years now. But it also helps a lot of SaaS companies and software-based companies roll out products, right? So one of the things we do is if you go to Zerto.com, if you ever want to put your hands on a new piece of their software, you just click a button. It talks to our API. It goes and delivers you one of these classrooms with the Zerto software, vCenter server, ESXi. Yeah. The student can log in, test it, and then blow it away. So it's a full automated lab system with many use cases. It's been really successful.
Yeah, for me, it's like the epitome of doing great things with great tech, right? Like you guys are leveraging your API, you're leveraging ESX, you're leveraging the different vendor technologies to deliver something that is consumable, but also something that you guys have productized. That's pretty awesome. And just lastly, Catalyst. Like that was again, one of those things I think you innovated with.
Yeah. So Catalyst was also a big one. So if you remember, or probably still have to deal with on a day-to-day basis at Veeam, is when you do DR or you're just trying to scope a DR solution for a customer, it's not just about how much bandwidth you have and what data you need to move. There's the networks, there's red flags on the VMware infrastructure, like if they have RDMs or different version of tools, there's all these things, if you will, that need to be checked. So what we did was we created a tool that the customer can just simply run. It's a small Golang application. You can point it at your vCenter and it gets a complete inventory. It runs a bandwidth check to all the ILAN sites. You can VMs in multiple groups to say like, hey, it's going to take, you know, 2 hours for this group to go and your incremental is going to be 15 minutes. It basically is an A to Z checklist of validating a customer has what they need for what they want to backup or replicate to an ILAN data center. And then the result of that is that data gets saved within some of those internal tools that I mentioned to make people's jobs like solutions architects and salespeople make their jobs a lot easier, right? So it gives us a very go or no-go checklist about what the customer wants to do.
Yeah.
The customer gets a nice report on if it's going to be successful. And it helps our internal operations too to say, hey, look, this customer wants to do this. Everything has checked out. Go ahead and automatically deploy.
That's amazing. I love that. Yeah, that's great. And that's very unique in the industry as well in terms of just that automated way to go out and gather information for the greater good there. So that's awesome. Just a final question. So what you mentioned the tech partners that you've used along the way. So what, in your opinion, makes a great technology partner?
I think, in my opinion, is somebody who continues to stay innovative on what they're doing, right? If it's a backup product, what are they bringing to the table on releases? Obviously, having an API level integration and something that works as far as a programmatic approach. And I think the biggest thing is the relationship. You know, tech companies can be great, but having a person to talk to, having a person to escalate to, having a product manager to bounce feedback off of and get a roadmap delivered to me, that's the crux of it. I would say 50-50, right? It's 50% technology and 50% relationship. Because if you think about it, there's a lot of great technology out there, but if the support's not good or the interaction's not good with the vendor, I don't know, you know, if that's a huge win. So yeah. For me, it's I would say 50% relationship and 50% technology.
Yeah. Cool. Awesome. Well, this has been great. It's been great talking through the history of ILAND, you know, from that web hosting developer days of the 90s through to virtualization, through to the pivot to DR, and now, you know, all the way through LabWorks and Catalyst. I think the story of ILAND's great. You guys are doing really well. You're everywhere, 10 locations, and continue to innovate with the technology. So thanks for that. And let's start to wrap up. So, you know, this is great things with great tech. Obviously, we're going to put the show notes up. We'll put links to ILAND, links to Justin, you know, anything that they want to put up there, we'll have on the show notes. You can find me at anthonyspiteri.net, and great things at great tech can be found on Twitter now, GTWGT podcast. If you aren't subscribed or you're new to the show and you would like to hear more about it, please subscribe to us through any podcast client. You can catch up via the web on gtwgt.com. All the episodes are up there. The new site design is going live pretty soon. Pretty excited about that. And with that, thank you, Justin. Thank you, ILAND. And we will see you next time. Cheers.
Thanks.
All right. Cool. Got through that.
It went very quickly.
It does go quick, doesn't it?